CFUV 101.9 FM broadcasts from the Songhees and Wasanich territories, also known as Victoria, BC. You can listen to our music, spoken word, and multicultural programs anywhere, anytime at cfuv.ca.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio's first program of the year, recorded December 30th, 2021, and January 3rd, 2022. Well, honestly, we know the United States was never just. It's a human rights horror show now and always has been. Yes, America, the propaganda construct, is a triumph. We often have to remind ourselves of its genocides, slavery, and wars of plunder. But to any with even superficial familiarity, expecting justice from America is beyond naive. That's why some in Britain were surprised when their appellate court served journalist, publisher, and political prisoner Julian Assange into the maw of America's industrial prison complex. But then justice is a stranger these days in England too. Andy Worthington is an English journalist, activist, author, photo historian, filmmaker, musician, songwriter, and principal of the Four Fathers Band. He is too co-founder of both the ongoing Close Guantanamo campaign and successfully completed We Stand With Shaker campaign. Worthington's book titles include The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, Stonehenge, Celebration and Subversion, and The Battle of the Beanfield. Andy's articles appear at his website, andyworthington.co.uk, where he's inviting again participants for 2022's Close Guantanamo effort. Andy Worthington in the first half. And regarding mastery of the propagandist's art, British playwright Harold Pinter lauded in his 2005 Nobel Prize for Literature acceptance speech America for its, quote, brilliant, even witty, highly successful act of hypnosis. How else to explain the serial crimes of our near neighbor, crimes committed without answer to any court, let alone broad public disgust or censure? Kim Goldberg is a Nanaimo-based poet, journalist, and author. She's written 8 books of poetry and nonfiction, including her most recent collection, Devolution, Poems and Fables of Ecopocalypse. She also publishes at Substack, where her recent article, Mass Formation, How the Left Got Duped, examines the method, means, and implications of a society in the throes of mass hypnosis. Kim Goldberg and Watching More Than the Watch in the second half. But first, Andy Worthington and what the Assange verdict and commencement of Gitmo's 20th year means for the real rule of law. Well, welcome back to the program, Andy.
Thank you, Chris. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Andy, as I said in the intro, this month marks Gitmo's 20th anniversary and the 10th for your Close Guantanamo campaign, the one you co-founded. You've written an article at closeguantanamo.org about Alex Gibney's newly released film, The Forever Prisoner. It's about the CIA torture victim, Abu Zubaydah. What's Abu Zubaydah's story, Andy?
Well, he's, you know, in a way, he's the most significant victim of the torture program that was set up by the Bush administration and the CIA after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, because he was the person for whom the torture program was approved. And as I would hope your listeners all remember or know, Chris, the torture program was approved by lawyers in the Justice Department facility that was particularly responsible for advising the executive branch, who told the Bush administration that essentially whatever they wanted to do to the people they captured was fine, because these lawyers revised the definition of torture. In the hope that that torturing people would no longer count as torture. The whole thing, you know, was just extraordinarily horrible and cynical. And Abu Zubaydah was, captured in a house raid in Pakistan in March 2002. He was shot. He was very badly wounded. But he was whisked immediately to the first of the CIA's black sites in Thailand, where they managed to keep him alive, but, you know, started the process of the horrible torture to which he was subjected. And he was then flown around the majority of the other black sites that were set up, some of them in Eastern Europe, one that was briefly in existence in Guantanamo for about 6 months in 2003, 2004, until the US authorities realized that the Supreme Court was getting a bit too close and was about to grant habeas rights to the prisoners, and then moved to another location. This whole horrible, dirty story of, you know, buying off foreign governments, prevailing on them in various ways to host something which, you know, would simply not have been allowed on US soil. And this dirty trail of torture prisons that the CIA had all around the world, and to which Abu Zubaydah was subjected. Now, in 2006, having denied the existence of the prisons for as long as he'd been asked about them, George W. Bush suddenly admitted that they had existed, but that they'd all been closed down. And the last men who were held in them were moved to Guantanamo. These were the 14 high-value detainees who arrived in September 2006. And it was at that point, you know, quite genuinely, I think, that that the only senior figures accused of involvement with terrorism actually arrived at Guantanamo. Of all the hundreds and hundreds of people who had previously been held at the prison, there was nobody that held any alleged senior leadership position in Al-Qaeda at all. You know, the majority of the men held at Guantanamo were insignificant or nobodies, really. And so Abu Zubaydah has now been held at Guantanamo for 15 years as one of the forever prisoners. So a man who is not going to be put on trial, but who the United States insists that it can keep holding forever. And of course, the truly horrible twist in Abu Zubaydah's case is that cables that emerged that were sent from the torture site to CIA headquarters in Langley discussed Abu Zubaydah. First of all, what they were going to do with him if he died during the torture, and then seeking reassurances that no one would be held accountable. And Langley wrote back to the interrogator saying, no, this man will be held isolated, you know, forever, and will be held incommunicado and will not be freed. And, you know, here's the position that Abu Zubaydah is still in all these years later, as somebody outside of all of the norms of due process and guilt and charges, everything. In the case of Abu Zubaydah, the CIA and the Bush administration decided that he was enormously significant. They decided that he was the number three in Al-Qaeda. Now, certainly the FBI, you know, had was already aware of his story. I believe that parts of the CIA were. He was by no account the number three in Al-Qaeda. Everybody should have known that. What he was a logistician for an independent training camp in Afghanistan that wasn't affiliated with Al-Qaeda. So, you know, this makes the story, you know, almost unbelievably horrible and lawless and unjust and wrong, I think, Chris, that in so many ways that so many people knew that he wasn't who they were saying that he was. And yet he was, you know, subjected to this truly appalling treatment. He was waterboarded on 83 separate occasions.
Yeah, and who can forget the pictures that were featured on the nonstop on the through the media? It was almost as if it was meant to reassure Americans that somebody was paying a price, somebody was being published or punished rather, and never really to consider the humanity of this individual, let alone the kinds of atrocities being visited on the legal framework, because this kind of attitude and this disregard for the so-called rule of law was set to spread, as many people predicted it would do, to other cases. Tell me a little bit, Andy, about some of the other prisoners that ended up there. People, and I'm thinking of the Canadian Omar Khadr, but there's many others too that had absolutely nothing to do with Al Qaeda or the 9/11 or anything like that.
Most of the people who were held there were either soldiers who were in Afghanistan because they'd, you know, been fighting against the Northern Alliance before 9/11 happened. You know, pretty much nobody in Guantanamo. 9/11 happened and they immediately flew over to Afghanistan so that they could fight the United States. Everybody was engaged in an inter-Muslim conflict that, after 9/11 and the US-led invasion, suddenly meant that they were terrorists who were fighting against the United States. And so soldiers were rounded up as terrorists, denied of all their rights and, you know, given all of this appalling treatment. The Geneva Conventions were shredded. All the norms regarding deprivation of liberty were done away with. And we have this huge irony that soldiers were treated as terrorists, and yet terrorists who are people who have committed a crime, terrorism is a crime, were actually accused of being warriors. And you know, and in some ways, I think when some of those hearings have taken place at Guantanamo, some of those people accused of the 9/11 attacks, like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, has taken on this role of being a warrior. Because the United States has allowed that, has almost made him that, made him into a superhuman warrior rather than a criminal responsible for a truly horrendous crime, the killing of nearly 3,000 people on September 11, 2001. So the whole thing has been topsy-turvy and just wrong. But, you know, as I say, that I'm, you know, I think it's absolutely certain that the overwhelming majority of the people held at Guantanamo had no involvement whatsoever with the, you know, the decision-making process or the command structure in any way of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or any other terrorist organization. You know, and that's been such a huge problem all along. Some of the men still held, absolutely still fit in that category. And yet there is, sadly, you know, an enduring presence of the kind of hyperbole that was spouted by the Bush administration at the very, very beginning, that, you know, these guys are the worst of the worst. They would gnaw through the cables of the transport plane carrying them to Guantanamo if they could.
Yeah, they're very rodent-like, aren't they? Well, you in your article, The Forever Prisoner, Alex Gibney's new documentary, at your website, andyworthington.co.uk, you relate Gibney's description in the film, and I'll quote it, Abu Zubaydah was patient zero for the CIA torture program. That's the reason to investigate his story. And this is sort of the idea that all of this was used as a pry bar, a way to lever open the kind of legal protections that have been fought for in Western civilization for 800 years, starting in your own England, to render those protections that all of us enjoy and take for granted, or at least did until 2001, obsolete. And we've seen them unwind ever since.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. And, it, you know, it remains a problem. As long as a place like Guantanamo exists, as long as a torture program was introduced, really, you know, fundamentally at the highest level of the United States government, and has not, and no one responsible has ever been held accountable, as long as those realities still exist, then a different group of people could be subjected to torture at some point in the future. A different group of people could be sent to the legal black hole of Guantanamo, where, you know, where people literally have no rights. I mean, for the 39 men still held, 12 of them have been charged, but for the other 27, they've never been charged. But there is absolutely no mechanism that exists that will ensure that one day they're released from there, unless there is positive action on a political level by the president or by the Congress of the United States. Those men will never leave Guantanamo. They will die there, never having been charged with a crime. And so on a level of caring about your own self-interest, it should trouble the American people that this has been established in their name. But, you know, they've been told this is where the enemy is held. Why should they worry? I think it's the basis on which governments try to get away with whatever they can, Chris, by encouraging people to say, but I've got nothing to hide, as though our governments are fundamentally trustworthy. Whereas, you know, you don't really have to peek below the surface much to establish that at all kinds of levels, our governments are not fundamentally trustworthy. They do not have our best interests at heart.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Andy Worthington. Andy's an English journalist. He's an activist, author, photo historian, filmmaker, musician, songwriter, and principal of the Four Fathers Band. And he's the co-founder both of the Close Guantanamo campaign and successfully completed We Stand With Shaker campaign. Andy, his site is andyworthington.co.uk. He's inviting people this year, as he has every year for the last 10 years, for the 2022 version of the Close Guantanamo effort. When you said that it's up to the president to close this, Obama, when he first was elected the first time around, said it was going to be job one, but it never happened. His vice president, Joe Biden, doesn't seem like he's in any rush to do anything. You write about, at your site, the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings recently held. What does the Senate have to say about it? Is there, I mean, now that the war has been wound down in Afghanistan, isn't it a logical next step to say, okay, now let's just put an end to this?
Well, you would think so. And, you know, and actually, you know, Senator Dick Durbin, who's the, you know, second most senior Democrat and the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has been really strong on this. And he had support from many of his Democratic colleagues. The bottom line is that, you know, to some extent, some Democrats don't really care. And to the other extent, which is probably more significant, to be honest, is that it's not as though the Democrats have absolute power in the Senate. It's on a complete knife edge, the Senate. So they have a majority in the House. In the House this year, the annual National Defense Authorization Act, which for 10 years since Obama's time, the Republicans have put in serious restrictions on releasing prisoners from Guantanamo and closing the facility. They attempted to remove some of these problems. But when it came to reconciling the House version with the Senate version, then the Senate won out and these restrictions are still in place. And I noticed that just a few days ago, Joe Biden signed the NDAA and criticized the restrictions on Guantanamo, exactly like Barack Obama did every year at this time of year. When, you know, and no one is prepared to go the extra step. So the problem with Obama was that he was simply unwilling to spend the political capital going the extra mile to make sure that the place was closed. And after a year under Biden, in which we've seen nothing apart from one prisoner released and eight men approved for release, but who are still not freed, he has done pretty much the barest minimum. And it's clearly not at the top of his in-tray at all.
Well, I wonder if beyond political expediency, it might be an understanding or a recognition in the United States that if Guantanamo didn't exist, they would have to invent it or reinvent it for the various forever wars going on around the world and for troublesome people that they would like to hold outside of the norms of political and legal process like Julian Assange. There's been a development in his case a couple of weeks ago. He had won a stay of extradition in the British courts. That was appealed by the United States. And the British court has agreed with the appeal and says it will be willing to send Julian Assange off to wherever land in the United States or within the American judicial maw, as I described it earlier. You have an intimate connection, Andy, with both WikiLeaks and the Julian Assange case. Do you want to talk first about that connection that you have with WikiLeaks?
Well, yeah, I mean, I worked with Julian Assange and with WikiLeaks on the release of the Guantanamo files back in 2011. So, you know, part of the last amount of documents that were leaked to WikiLeaks by Chelsea Manning. So, you know, obviously I've been watching the case very closely over all these years. You know, as a media partner listed on the WikiLeaks website as a media partner, along with all of these other broadcasters and newspapers that you know, that worked alongside Julian Assange and WikiLeaks for all those years in publishing the war cables and the diplomatic cables. And yet the only person who has been singled out, you know, for punitive punishment by the United States is Julian Assange. You know, with these Espionage Act charges hanging over him. And it's, you know, it's profoundly disappointing on two levels, really, Chris. A, that the British courts refused to defend press freedom by not allowing Julian Assange to be extradited. And secondly, you know, that the United States under President Biden has continued with this request for his extradition, which was initiated under Donald Trump. Now, we know that the Obama administration had looked at going after Julian Assange. You know, Julian Assange's attitude to the United States as he was revealing these secrets obviously enraged all of these people. But, you know, Obama and his people had looked at it and genuinely worried about the bleed from pursuing Julian Assange, who they hated, into the important principle of press freedom, which Democrats like to go after whistleblowers, but they also have to stand up for the right of the media in countries that claim to be, you know, liberal democracies in various ways, to be able to damaging to the government. The understanding is that without that, then you behave exactly as dictatorships do. And so I frankly am appalled that the United States hasn't dropped this extradition request. And I'm more appalled, I think, by that than I am by the judges in the UK. I say that. I'm appalled by the judges in the UK as well, Chris. I mean, they have accepted the lamest of assurances from the United States that Julian Assange, who, you know, with mental health issues that had previously led the judge to say, I believe that we cannot guarantee the safety of Julian Assange if he is sent to one of these horrendous supermax American prisons, that he will, you know, attempt to commit suicide. I'm appalled that British judges have accepted these assurances from the United States, because time and again, what's been shown in the cases, especially of people that the United States wants to extradite for hacking offences, all of whom are, you know, at some level have had Asperger's syndrome, for example. It has repeatedly been demonstrated in the British courts that the United States prison system is so inhumane, cruel and barbaric that it is not safe for people to be transferred there. And yet, you know, what we've also seen in the past is that that's generally applied to white people. It hasn't applied when it comes to Muslims. And here we're seeing that when it comes to Julian Assange, he's being stripped of his rights the way that Muslims have been in the past and isn't being given the general privilege that white people have when the U.S. wants to extradite them.
Well, it seems it's always seemed a little precious to me, this argument that he should be released because he might kill himself. I mean, how about he should be released because he shouldn't be held in the first place? Or how about because his health, mental and physical, is suffering because the way he's being treated, not because of any condition that he might suffer, regardless if he might suffer that, but that he's being treated in a way that would break most of us. I can't imagine the guy has gone through so much over this long period with no sense of hope that he's ever going to be delivered from that. I mean, who wouldn't be crushed by that?
Well, I absolutely agree, Chris, but I think that, you know, when you're dealing with the actual legal process, then you have to jump from one thing to another. So when it became, the lifeline was that this judge had refused to allow his extradition on the grounds of the suicide risk, and that became something that we had to embrace. It didn't, you know, it didn't remove the fact that what it conspicuously failed to do was to say, there's no way that I can extradite a journalist and publisher to the United States under these insane trumped up charges, because, you know, we will never have a free press again if this goes ahead. You know what I mean? It's, you know, unfortunately, we have to deal with whatever straws we could clutch.
Well, I understand that, of course. And I understand, too, that the idea that he's a member of the press, but he's also a citizen like the rest of us. And we're all, it has to be reiterated that we are all threatened. The rights of everyone is threatened if governments can lift people off the streets and drag them away. Again, in your article, The Forever Prisoner, you include, too, a quote, and it's something that David Smith related in The Guardian, and you include it, a quote from the CIA that was discovered in a cable release. And it says, and I'll quote them, that Abu Zubaydah will never be placed in a situation where he has any significant contact with others and should remain incommunicado for the remainder of his life. This is without charge and without a trial or anything like that. And to a great degree, we see Julian Assange is being held in much the same way, his communication with the outside world being severely limited.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. And you know, and I have to say that I think those similarities are significant. I think level of at Guantanamo, for example, all of the men who have been held in CIA black sites, now whether they are the ones who've been put forward for trial or the ones who haven't, in all of those cases, the CIA it seems pretty happy to have them just locked up and shut away forever, with minimal communication with the outside world, exactly fulfilling those requirements. And, you know, and the same thing with Julian Assange. And I can't help but think that in Julian Assange's case, this involves both the British and the American authorities, who are happy to just have him removed from the picture, imprisoned, suffering, and almost entirely prevented from communicating in any kind of meaningful way with the outside world. So, yes, very similar and very troubling stories.
Well, it's certainly the Assange case has certainly rendered the concept of British justice, the credibility of it, onion paper thin, just as in Canada, the Meng Wanzhou extradition fiasco did the same to Canadian justice. These two famously rule of law proponents that would trammel the world in defense of a legal principle that they don't feel constrained by at home. Andy, we're fast running out of time. So now it's quarterly fundraising time again for your work with the Close Guantanamo campaign, the 2022 campaign, just kicking off the 20th anniversary, as we mentioned before. What are you doing for the 20th edition, this necessarily constrained by the COVID protocols, etc., and how do people help?
Well, people can, you know, can donate if they wish to support either, you know, my website, andyworthington.co.uk, or the Close Guantanamo campaign, which is closeguantanamo.org. And both of those sites are places that I'll be publicizing things that are happening. So there's going to be a protest in London on January the 8th, unless there is a sudden lockdown, which I don't think there will be. It will be distanced and proportionate, but there will be a protest. And then I'm going to be involved in various online things as well, Chris, which I'm just setting up at the moment. So if people go to either of those sites, they'll find things publicized. And I also have an ongoing photo campaign based on a clock that I set up called the Gitmo clock, which counts in real time how long Guantanamo has been open. And the prison will have been open for 7,300 days on January the 5th. And 7,306 days on January the 11th, which is the 20th anniversary of the prison's opening. And what we do on occasions, which is generally every 100 days, we have a poster and we ask people to take a photo with it and to send it in to Close Guantanamo. And we've got pages on the website of people who care enough to make about it through a photograph. And it would be great if anybody wants to join us in that.
Well, closeguantanamo.org, or you can go to Andy's website, andyworthington.co.uk, and also check out the State of London photo essay that has gone similarly in time, watching some unbelievable changes that have gone on in this period, especially with these deserted streets of London during some of the lockdown periods and that. I wish you, Andy, the best for the new year and continued vigilance in your efforts to find justice for those 39 unfortunates, and also for everybody else that is represented by them, because they're suffering for the law, and that law, we would like to think, at least protects us, all of us, and that's under threat as well. Thanks again, Andy, for coming on, eh?
Thanks a lot, Chris. It's been a great pleasure. Until the next time.
All right, then. Hey, that's my tagline. All right, and I want everybody else stick around, because Kim Goldberg's coming up after the break. All right, then, Andy. Till the next time, indeed.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Okay, cheers. Bye. Adios.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999. Right here, 11 a.m. Thursdays at CFUV.ca.
We're running out of time to put out a fire. Fire.
I ain't giving up tonight. Even if you walk around.
Well, regarding mastery of the propagandist art, British playwright Harold Pinter lauded in his 2005 Nobel Prize for Literature acceptance speech America for its, quote, brilliant, even witty, highly successful act of hypnosis. How else to explain the serial crimes of our near neighbor, crimes committed without answer to any court, let alone broad public disgust or censure, but that the people are enstupored, victims of some malevolent, invisible mesmerist. But for those of us, the unconscionable acquiescence of the mob does not excuse an abandonment of our duty to the truth. As Pinter said in 2005, the search for the truth can never stop. It has to be faced right there on the spot. Kim Goldberg is a Nanaimo-based poet, journalist, and author. She's written 8 books of poetry and nonfiction, including her most recent collection, Devolution, Poems and Fables of Ecopocalypse. She's covered BC Current Affairs for Canadian Dimension magazine for many years, most recently on the Ferry Creek blockade. She also publishes at Substack, where her recent article, Mass Formation, How the Left Got Duped, examines the method, means, and implications of a society in the throes of mass hypnosis. Welcome back to the program, Kim.
Thank you very much, Chris. I'm happy to be here again.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Kim, in your article, you cite the work of Matthias Desmet, the psychologist and, quote, expert on tyranny and totalitarianism, and his work on mass formation, both past and present. What is mass formation, Kim?
Well, that, I think, is something very important to understand right now with what's going on. Of course, Matthias Desmet is a Belgian clinical psychoanalysis professor at University of Ghent. He's got quite a strong academic background in this. And when he's talking about mass formation, he's building on and often references the work of Gustave Le Bon and also, of course, Hannah Arendt in terms of how totalitarian societies come into being. So what he's really talking about, he uses the term mass formation, but also sometimes mass hypnosis. Other people, I think even Robert Malone on his recent interview with Joe Rogan refers to it as mass psychosis. And so it also gets that term. This is a situation in which a substantial portion of the population, but not all, and that's the critical part, a substantial portion of the population literally becomes mesmerized into a state of irrationality, a state of mental intoxication, Desmet says, and for a variety of preconditions, I'll mention those in a second. And once this happens, once these preconditions are there, if the correct unifying narrative comes along that can be put forth by a leader, by a despot, or of course, in our current society, more likely by mainstream media, if that's put forward, a large portion of the society, about 70% really, will get captured in this state of mass hypnosis. And almost anything can happen then. So I'd like to look at what Desmet says as a starting point, the 4 preconditions are for mass formation. He says mass formation, mass hypnosis actually can't even emerge unless these 4 conditions already exist in society, separate from whatever crisis is, you know, propelling people into this mass formation. So the 4 preconditions, and I mean, he's talking about basically all totalitarian systems within of the 20th century, and now, of course, we're moving into the 21st century, they all meet these criteria of the 4 preconditions. A large percentage of the population feels socially isolated and they lack good connections to other people, good, strong social bonds. That's the first precondition. The second is that people, a large number of people, are experiencing a lack of sense-making or meaning-making in the world at large, as well as in their own lives. They feel their lives and jobs are meaningless and senseless. but they also feel the larger world politically and otherwise isn't making sense. The third condition is a high degree of free-floating anxiety. And free-floating anxiety is apparently a very difficult, treacherous, traumatic experience for humans. Desmond says it's the most painful psychological condition a person can experience. And it's defined, it's anxiety that is not connected to a specific object. We all know what anxiety is when, you know, we're stressed about a dentist appointment, for example. But if you feel this perpetual level of anxiety leading to borderline panic attacks, and there is nothing to anchor it to, that's free-floating anxiety. And of course, it comes about because of those two previous conditions, the one in which people are socially isolated and their lives don't make sense. And then the fourth precondition is that there's a high degree of frustration and latent aggression in the population. That, of course, arises as a result of the free-floating anxiety, and that in turn is a result of those first two conditions of isolation and senselessness to existence. So he says, Desmond then goes on to say that not only are these four preconditions already fully fulfilled before in our society, our modern societies, before coronavirus struck, but under such conditions, a society is highly sensitive to narratives, particularly if these narratives are presented through the mainstream media. So, you know, that's really what we've had. A narrative comes along, an organized, deliberate narrative comes along to solve these problems, basically. First of all, to anchor that free-floating anxiety. So now we've got coronavirus. We've got a global pandemic. So everybody's free-floating anxiety, boom, it latches onto that. And so everybody's focused every malaise they may have had onto that now. And in so doing, he says that the population switches from this highly painful psychological state of social isolation to the opposite. They're now experiencing a high level of solidarity. So they've solved that problem of social isolation. They're bonded together with other people in this crush of solidarity. They're embarked on a noble mission to solve the problem of coronavirus. So their lives now have great meaning instead of no meaning. And the result of this, but this is actually quite dangerous. You might think this sounds good, but it's actually quite dangerous because it's a process that leads to really a mental intoxication and actually irrationality. It narrows the field of attention and focus until it contains only the subject of the official narrative, the corona narrative. And in this situation, it really is a state of hypnosis, and people will go along with anything, no matter how absurd, how blatantly wrong, and you can take away everything from them when they're in that state, and they won't see it because their focus has been narrowed to look at only the topic of the official narrative, the COVID pandemic. So it's really very problematic, and it's shutting down the rational mind, which can engage in critical analysis, can weigh pros and cons. All of that's gone out the window. And so, as Desmond's pointing out, this corona narrative can get increasingly more absurd, increasingly more false, filled and riddled with non sequiturs, and people will just keep going forward with it.
Before the corona, there was, and still is, the climate crisis. This is something that's focused the attention of the media and people and created this sense of anxiety. So, I mean, the object of focus is interchangeable both over time and in subject as well. One can be replaced with the other, but in the 1920s, where radio was the emerging media and it was phenomenal, now we've got this huge all-encompassing media machine going across mediums, television and computers and everything else, hitting us nonstop.
Absolutely. And I think you're completely right that it is interchangeable. We could have the narrative from the 20s and the 30s could just as well be the narrative today or vice versa. And you're right, the different mediums used to propel this narrative, they may change over time, but the process seems to be the same and maybe even more intense now, I wonder, because of people's connectivity, much higher connectivity with social media.
And it's concomitant isolation, it seems, in what we would call the real world, where people have thousands of friends on Facebook or on other platforms. But in effect, they're sitting isolated, not really enjoying any of the tactile or emotionally reinforcing aspects of friendship or love or family even.
That's true, too. And then the coronavirus itself keeps people more isolated. In fact, this COVID narrative is theoretically knitting people together into this great crush of solidarity, united on a noble mission. At the same time, people also aren't able to communicate. Just shortly before the whole COVID pandemic launched here in North America in early 2020, a bank I deal with wouldn't let Muslim women, they had to not be masked in any way. And then, of course, within a matter of weeks, that policy was changing to where you couldn't get service at the bank if you weren't masked.
But doesn't that fall right into the purview of this idea of mass formation idea where what is normal today is entirely opposite tomorrow, but there's no explanation of why that is. People are just expected to accept it. This the absurdity of the narrative and its constant changing is a feature of that.
Absolutely. And it's not just that people are expected to accept it. They do accept it because it's their lifeline. It's what's given them their sanity back, their clarity. They were living in a state of uncertainty that was so extreme, they were borderline panic attack, whether they realized it or not. And that's now been removed. They've been given answers. They've been given procedures to follow that will save them, whether it does or not, whether it can be incredibly absurd. Matthias Desmet uses this word absurd throughout. You know, it's interesting with Desmet, the next stage on the Desmet thing, and this is the part that interests me the very most, is who gets trapped in mass formation and who manages to stay outside? Because it's never 100% of the population in any of these cases that lands in mass formation. So Desmet says that at the outset of any mass formation, the population is always, there are always three groups that develop right away, and they always have approximately the same proportion. They're divided into roughly equal thirds. Now that may change over time as the mass formation progresses, but initially they're at roughly even thirds. And so the first third are fully hypnotized and they're the true believers in the narrative. They're really quite unshakable and they account for 30 to 35% of the population in the beginning. The second group are those who are going along mainly out of convenience, self-preservation, or to avoid the scorn and the wrath of the true believers. And they may partially believe the narrative. It's convenient to believe it. Everybody around them is saying these same things. And so they're in their game. They haven't questioned too much, but they're also mainly there for convenience. And they account for 30 to 35% of the population. And then the final third is the group who reject the narrative from the outset, who see it as false, and they're speaking out publicly, and they account for about 30% of the population. Now, people can move, and particularly in that second group, the ones who are there for convenience, who are partially committed, but they can, if that other group that sees this narrative as false, that final third group, if the society is free enough that they can keep speaking out, that they won't be rounded up or they won't be killed, if they can continue to speak publicly, then the second group can quite often be moved, at least part of it, into the third group. And that really would destabilize and derail any kind of totalitarian juggernaut. You have to have, for totalitarianism to succeed, you have to have a certain large percentage of the population within the mass forming narrative. And the more people in that second group who come out and come over to the third and see the narrative as false, well, then you're just ultimately left with that original 30% who, for whatever reason, are fully hypnotized and are true believers. And that's not really enough for totalitarianism, unless it's just brutal and then shifts more to bloody dictatorship. But totalitarianism, the point Desmet makes, is totalitarianism doesn't function as a bloody dictatorship. It functions with the support of the population. So it does need to have a certain baseline support. And that initial 30% of the true believers, the fully hypnotized, that's not enough. Honestly, that gives me hope that we can that this is still in flux, still in play. I think I have the sense that now here we are actually starting the third year of COVID, essentially, with this. I have the sense that more and more people actually are starting to ask questions, or even in their own private lives are starting to think, does this really make sense?
Well, and questioning is another element of this, and I want to get to that in a second. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today to Kim Goldberg. Kim's an Nanaimo-based poet. She's a journalist and author. She's written 8 books of poetry and nonfiction, including her most recent collection, Devolution, Poems and Fables of Eco-Apocalypse. And as I've said before, she's covered current affairs for Canadian Dimension magazine. She most recently at the Ferry Creek blockade. And she publishes, most importantly, I think nowadays, up at Substack, where her recent article, Mass Formation, How the Left Got Duped, we are speaking about today. And it examines the methods, means, and implications of a society in the throes of mass hypnosis. My words, not hers. Well, Kim, there's a couple of things now. Hannah Arendt is... along with Gustav Le Bon, Hannah Arendt is cited by Matthias Desmet, Dr. Matthias Desmet, I should add, and her work, her seminal work, The Origins of Totalitarianism. A lot of people might know her too from her most famous work, The Banality of Evil, talking about the Eichmann trial and just how the Nazis, or how the Germans, how some Germans, I should say, became Nazis and the origins of that. There's a quote in Arendt's book that I can't resist, and it says, "Men have been found to resist the most powerful monarch and to refuse to bow down before them, but few indeed have been found to resist the crowd." And this is this most powerful aspect of your peer pressure, as it's called when you're a teenager.
Yeah.
The environment we are in today, especially in the media, and here, if I'm hesitating, I'm wondering how close to a line, an invisible line, but an understood tacit one, I can get without getting myself into trouble and losing my access to communication in this kind of form. We've seen people deplatformed and pulled off of various outlets and everything else for even questioning something that is obviously in need of questioning. There's organizations and there's departments of government set up to question the efficacy of drugs, to test them. There's protocols that are well established. But in our current situation, even though a lot of those safeguards and protocols have not been met, have been brushed aside in an emergency manner, but even questioning why that happened leads us to be charged with being the other, or with presenting a threat to society as a whole, and labeled all kinds of things.
Well, labeled first and foremost anti-vax. I mean, the number of people now who are fully vaccinated individuals, but are questioning the scientific validity of, say, vaccine passports and vaccine mandates, they are now labeled and smeared by everyone as anti-vax, despite the fact that they're fully vaccinated and are ready to go get their boosters. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, the actual dictionary definition of anti-vax has now been changed, expanded, I should say, to include criticism of vaccine mandates, regardless of the individual's vaccination status.
So this again is like this mass formation where the goalposts keep changing and people are down the memory hole goes the past, you know. Well, it was one vaccine, then it was two, then it's three, now it's four, and now there's talk of five and maybe perennial ones.
Exactly. I think I just read that this morning. Netherlands perhaps is talking about fifth and sixth boosters, or planning for them. And right, so perennial, it's become, you know, an institution, what was going to be two, which is also interesting. That is the moving goalposts. But in terms of how this relates to mass formation and that second group, the people who aren't that committed, I have a lot of friends in that group. And those people were willing to go get the two shots. They figured they're doing their bit, but they never in their minds imagined they would just keep doing it. So I think we're already seeing quite a lot of instability in that second group within the mass formation. And I think things will be shifting. You know, I'd like to just say something for a moment here. I mean, the mass formation information is very important, and I think is at the, you know, the foundation of everything we're looking at here today. But the question that has come up for me from the beginning, and which is what I tried to tackle in my article, Why was the left so particularly targeted? In that first group, in Desmet's construction of mass formation, the 30% who are completely hypnotized, who completely believe in the narrative, in my opinion, that is mainly made up of people on the left, the progressive left, socialists, Marxists, Greens, eco-socialists, more so than any other demographic of the political spectrum. So I was asking myself, well, why would the left go there particularly? Because the left has historically championed civil rights. It's historically championed free speech. It's historically, you know, been critical of big government, government overreach, government surveillance and tracking. Would have certainly been critical of big pharma and injuries that big pharma could, in its pursuit of lucre, be imposing on the population. And certainly the left, I mean, has made its bones on bodily autonomy. You know, my body, my choice. I marched in all of those leftist marches and rallies back in the 70s. That's the basis of the left. So why has the left, more than any other sector of the population, jettisoned all that seemingly to get rush into this mass formation? Well, I think the left was specifically targeted with some very clever messaging. You know, you'll notice that most of the messaging right from the beginning about COVID, up from our public health officials, government public health officials, and then filtered through mainstream media and repeated endlessly, is pseudo-empathetic and pseudo-collectivist in tone. Now, this very much will appeal to left sensibilities, collectivist sensibilities. So we're told, my mask protects you, your mask protects me, my shot protects you, your shot protects me. We're all in this together. That's been repeated over and over. And I think that's really, more than anything, was done deliberately to bring the left on board. Because let's face it, if there's going to be some ramp up of global, it would appear, authoritarianism, in which we're, and you don't even have to go down a conspiracy theory road to get to this place, we're already looking at QR codes on these vaccine passports, and virtually already at the point of digital ID that will have our health records on it and other personal data and information. With an agenda like that, or an objective like that, I shouldn't say agenda, who knows, with a seeming objective like that, the left would be the loudest critics of something like that. So if it's going to work, the left has to be not just derailed and silenced, but actually brought on board as champions and cheerleaders of this new way forward. Otherwise, the left would be performing its historic social function of critiquing that, and critiquing it with moral authority and critiquing it with intelligence. So that has to be prevented. It was by this deliberate messaging, pseudo-empathetic, pseudo-collectivist, we're all in this together. And I think that's how the left got slotted into that first group in Matthias Desmet's structure of mass formations, the true believers.
Well, people that are seen as resisting inoculation or resisting mandates are depicted as being fraidy cats. And I'll admit, I'm a fraidy cat in the sense that I my entire political formation has been based on what I witnessed as a kid, as many of us did in the films of what happened in Nazi Germany and the horrible place that led to, and wondering how was it possible that people would abandon culture and morality and everything else so easily, so quickly, jettison a whole civilization and follow down this path that made absolutely no sense. And it seems to me that the philosophy that led to the gas chambers never was vanquished. And now I fear that it is again rearing its head in another guise. And that's my big fear.
Well, that's my fear too. That's absolutely my fear. And, you know, I'm sure you've noticed, Chris, there's an awful, anytime anybody tries to make the comparison between vaccine mandates and the totalitarian direction this appears to be leading, makes the comparison with Nazi Germany. You know, we're told that, you know, that's just horrifically offensive, and how dare you take the name of the Holocaust in vain like that and apply it to what's basically just, you know, public welfare and public health. But I can tell you, I I am a Jew, and as a Jew, and I've had, you know, a huge portion of my family perished in the Holocaust, my Jewish family ancestors. I feel very connected to that history. And I am just at a visceral level terrified about what may be coming. People who test COVID negative, they do not have COVID, they're healthy individuals, they have been removed from their homes and placed in a quarantine facility. It actually is happening already. And so I don't think the comparison is inappropriate or insensitive or offensive at all. I think it is spot on. And I think actually, you know, you're right. We all grew up with the information about Nazi Germany and what happened, and with some incredulity about how could an ordinary population get themselves into that state of accepting that, of either turning away, not looking, in some cases actively participating. Well, this is how. This is the incremental way in which it happens, you know. There are many buildings I'm not allowed into anymore right now, and for no reason, for no actual valid, meaningful public health reason. The vaccine passport system does not allow me into quite a few buildings or on any transportation like planes or trains.
Well, Kim, we can't possibly do this subject justice for a number of reasons in this format. I urge people to go to kimgoldbergx1.substack.com to read her articles, Substack being so far an unregulated or uncensored platform. How else, Kim, can people get see your work on this subject and others?
I think that's probably the best. I've also been tweeting on it quite a bit, so people can look for me on Twitter, Kim Pigsquash. I know that's a little odd, but who knows how long I'll stay alive on Twitter, because Twitter has been one of the platforms that's been doing a great amount of censoring and deplatforming. So, but I think between Substack and Twitter, that's the best way.
Well, I can guarantee, Kim, that you're the only Kim Pig Squash on Twitter's vast.
Yes, I think you're right.
well, thanks again, Kim, and I will say stay healthy and everything, for coming on again today and telling us a little bit more about what you're worried or interested about, at least at this point. And I want to also thank Andy Worthington and remind you to keep an eye on Gitmo and the Close Guantanamo campaign, another manifestation of an unchecked fascistic tendency that we see rising all too prominently in these years of these early years of the new century. Thanks again, Kim, for coming on, eh?
Thank you very much, Chris.
And I want everyone else to stick around. There's great programming coming up. You know that, but that's all I've got for this week. Until the next time.
And I work at the UVSS Food Bank and Free Store. We are excited to announce that we are back up and running in the food bank, located in the basement of the sub, room B005. All undergraduate students at UVic are able to access the food bank once every week. All you have to do is sign up in advance online at uvss.ca/foodbank.